Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this beautiful day in Appleton. It is July 23rd, and we are broadcasting live from the History Museum at the Castle in Appleton. We have a lovely audience in a beautiful room. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Very nice of you to be here. And please join in the conversation. We're going to talk politics the first hour of the program, and we'll talk about the stars the second hour of the program. Just an announcement for those of you who missed the show yesterday, and we're looking forward to the hour, particularly about Walter Cronkite's life. I loved Walter Cronkite. Oh, I had a family emergency. Everything is okay now, but we are going to do that show, Rhonda promised me, because I got to talk about Walter. So that will be down the road, a couple weeks, okay? This hour of the program, politics, we have so much going on the healthcare front. As a guest said on Monday of this week, for all things political, it's going to be all Obama all the time this week on healthcare, and indeed that has been the case so far. And we are going to look at his healthcare reform plan and ask the question, if he has lost control of the plan, who is controlling the plan, what are the plans that are out there, and will we indeed see any kind of healthcare reform during the course of this year? Our guests are also heavily interested and knowledgeable about foreign affairs. We'll talk about the climate change bill, about revamping our approach to foreign aid. We'll look at the economy, so a number of issues on the table during this hour, so it's kind of an all things political for us on a Thursday instead of a Monday. We have two guests with us. Joining us in our studio at the History Museum at the Castle, George Waller is with us. George is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin in Fox Valley and has an interest in all kinds of issues. He went to school at Marquette and University of North Dakota and UWM. His areas of expertise, American government, political institutions and processes, and public policy, particularly criminal justice policy and environmental policy, and he has been looking extensively and following the healthcare debate for quite some time. George, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Also joining us is Jason Brozek, Assistant Professor of Government, and Stephen Edward Scharf, Professor of International Affairs at Lawrence University. His special interests are war and international security. He went to Madison, and he's been a member of the Lawrence faculty since 2008. He teaches topics on international law, war and peace, environmental politics, international economics, and U.S. foreign policy. Welcoming phone calls first, those of you who are in our audience, when whenever you would like to speak, what are we doing? They'll just come up to the microphone. So please, you have priority because here you are and here we are, and that would be nice. And we'll do that in just a few minutes. If you'd like to call in today, our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let's start with health care. It has been Obama all the time this week. George, do you think that the president has lost control of the health care debate?
No, I don't think he's lost control as of yet. I think Obama established early on with this healthcare initiative or healthcare reform initiative that he wasn't going to do what the Clinton administration did, which was to essentially write and define a bill from the White House and from the administration to deliver to the Congress. Instead, Obama said he was going to wait for the Congress to work out a lot of the proposals and a lot of the elements of the plan. I think what we've been seeing is a kind of sense that Congress is doing what Congress ordinarily does, which is a lot of conflicting proposals and a lot of political negotiation that is ongoing. I think Barack Obama last night established at least some parameters of what he would define as acceptable or unacceptable in a plan as it emerges from the House and Senate, but we are at this point too early to decide exactly what's going to emerge and exactly how it's going to have an impact on Americans.
Jason, do you think we'll get some kind of major reform by the end of this year? No reform, or just a little bit of a change in what we have now?
I think we'll see something before the August recess, and I think we'll see something more definitive probably in September. One of the things I thought was really interesting, going back to the June 23rd press conference on healthcare, in that press conference, Obama said that unless we fix what's broken in our current system, everyone's healthcare will be in jeopardy, rising premiums, declining benefits, denied coverage. Last night, I thought that he helped to solidify what he meant by that exactly. And one of the things he said last night that I thought was really fascinating is that the bill I signed must slow the growth of healthcare costs in the long run. And in my mind, that's far more important and far more difficult than a new system of insurance regulations, healthcare marketplaces, bureaucratic efficiencies. And to me, that means dealing with dealing with something I've seen called MALS, Modern American Life Syndrome.
I like that. What is that exactly?
I think it includes a whole raft of things. Obesity, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, physical inactivity, modern American life.
Right. So you got to ride your bike, like you do to get to work. That's, there's a lot of that. Let me ask the audience on this issue, because it seems to me those issues gone from one place to another in the last few months. How many of you in the audience are in favor, think that there's something very wrong with our healthcare system? It's most of the audience. How many of the audience feel as though you've heard a plan from somebody, I don't care who, that would rectify what ails us? A few of you have. You're kind of, okay, that's interesting. So the plan maybe isn't out there. The other question I have is, we've been doing this series on healthcare in other countries, and this idea about insuring everybody seems to me as though it's not really a political idea. It doesn't necessarily have any kind of Democratic bent or Republican bent, but it seems to be very hard for us, and we're all affected by it. We can all lose our health care just like that. It's hard for us as a country to say we all should have health care. It's not really a controversial issue, is it, that we should all have health care, but we have a heck of a time embracing that. Why is that?
I think there are a number of reasons for that. As many are probably aware, most industrialized, advanced democracies of the world have dealt with this issue of what to do about providing health care for their citizenry long, long ago. I think part of the problem here in the United States is that we're only now beginning to wrestle with what to do with it, and we have a system of employer-based private insurance that has been so entrenched for so long that to do something radical by way of changing away from that to something like a single-payer system is just something I think is unfathomable for Americans, and I think it's very, very difficult for politicians to deal with. I think there are obviously economic ramifications for scrapping the system we currently have, and I think they're working within those parameters to try and see how we can rescue the current employer-based system and still also deal with things like out-of-control healthcare costs and other issues. I think Jason was right on point when he mentioned that the biggest issue here has to do with cost containment. Mm-hmm. It also has to do with something that was mentioned last night in a question to the president about the kinds of sacrifices that Americans may have to make in order to achieve real reform in healthcare. And that's an area that there hasn't been a whole lot of conversation about. I think Jason's exactly right about the American lifestyle syndrome that needs to be addressed.
Right. And what about the issue of cost containment? We seem to have a lot of disagreement among Democrats. Pelosi is saying that we got to be very careful of taxing people who will make under $500,000 a year, a surcharge tax on this. Is there no other way to pay for this, that we're going to have to embrace people who make more money in this country being taxed to pay for health care for all?
I think so. The statistic I've heard is that about two-thirds of the funding for the new program already exists in the tax code now. So we're not talking about paying for new $1 trillion of funding. We're talking about paying for a third of that. So I think that the cost of the program gets overblown a little bit. And I think if we really do focus on containing costs and slowing the growth of healthcare costs and on preventative medicine, if we focus on preventing people from getting to the point where they need to go to the emergency room with something that could have been handled with a much lower cost preventative visit to a public doctor, then we've really controlled the cost and we've brought the cost of the entire program down, and we deal with some of those cost issues before they happen.
The other thing that I think some people are worried about is if we do get some kind of public option, it's kind of a weird line of reasoning here. If we get a line of public help for health care, then the private insurance companies are going to eventually down the road, maybe sooner than later, go out of business because the government plan might be better and cheaper, and so we can't have a government plan.
Yeah.
It just seems convoluted in a way. Am I missing something?
No, I think that's what you hear in the debate. I think there's a couple of things I would like to mention. I think, first of all, the idea that that there is a lot of competition in the health insurance industry, I think, is something that needs to be looked at a little bit more closely. I don't think there's as much competition among health insurance providers as they seem to suggest. I also believe that the idea of including the public option is one that is essentially focused on the idea of cost containment. Unless there is competition for the provision of health care from a public option, it seems to me that there is no incentive for private insurance companies who currently provide those plans to provide affordable insurance to Americans. I think by including the public option, the idea here is that it will force greater competition in the provision of affordable insurance premiums for Americans. And I think that is a part of what's involved with that public option.
Let's talk about all that this administration is dealing with and take an international swing here for a moment before we go to phone calls, and we got many of them, and to people in the audience. There is so much here on the table, and you wanted to, and we've done shows on this, and things were happening so rapidly you forget what was said 4 months ago because we're on to these other major topics. Focus on Pakistan or whatever country you'd like, but we talked about this in terms of Pakistan, that our foreign aid package was going to now go in a whole different direction. We were going to hold people accountable in that country. We were going to try and give more money to schools, to building infrastructure in the country, et cetera. Have we seen a change?
We've seen talk about a change. And this is a change. Bottom-up approach to aid rather than a top-down approach to aid is something that a lot of private aid organizations welcome and really applaud. Obama remarked on problems with the current system during his trip to Africa. Clinton talked about it just a few days ago in a speech to the Council on Foreign Relations. The problem is that these traditional top-down aid models, the kind that Obama and Clinton are criticizing, the kind that the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank provide, they prove to be ineffective. Long-term aid doesn't create long-term economic growth or stability. Bottom-up aid packages, what some authors call aid entrepreneurs, according to organizations like Oxfam or the Red Cross, these are far more effective approaches to aid. There's an author named Bill Easterly who writes about aid planners versus aid searchers and criticizes the World Bank and the IMF as aid planners, that they'll walk into an impoverished state and tell them what to do with the money and when to do it and provide the expertise to do it. Bill Easterly supports a program of aid searchers where organizations with money will go to an impoverished state and say, what do you need us to do? What would you like? Mm. What would help? I think that's the direction that Obama and Clinton are moving toward. As they start to turn that into policy, I think they're going to run into far more opposition because being an aid entrepreneur, being a searcher, reduces the ability of the United States to achieve its own interests with aid, which has been a cornerstone of U.S. aid policy.
It is remarkable. I've said this once, but I'll say it again. How much is on the table right now, isn't it, George? There's so many issues.
There certainly are. And, you know, the president came into office and actually ran a campaign promising to put a lot on the table. Mm-hmm. And I think we're seeing that play out. I think there are a number of reasons for that. I think purely on a from the standpoint of political observation, it makes sense for a president early in his administration with these kinds of circumstances to put forward a broad agenda. One always knows that as an administration winds through its term in office, the ability to accomplish things tends to diminish. It's important when you've got big issues and big problems to take care of that you put that stuff on the table and begin work on it. Barack Obama has stated, and he stated again last night, that the reason for the August deadline is if you don't impose deadlines in Washington, nothing gets done. And I think he's absolutely correct on that. A broad agenda, big problems, and things need to be earnestly considered.
How do you think he's doing, Jason?
I think so far, I think he's receiving criticism from the left, criticism from the right.
He must be doing fine.
Yeah. I think that's a good measure of success. Yeah. I think we're going to, as we move into the fall, I think we get into a bigger test. As the healthcare debate starts to really come to a head, as we start to transition the healthcare debate into the climate change debate, I think as we move into the fall, we're really going to see a bigger test.
George, what do you think?
Oh, I think Jason's absolutely correct. Right now, we're just seeing the preliminaries as to what's going to finally emerge with this healthcare bill. My prediction is that something will come out of this. I think we're going to see something by the end of August, before the August recess, and I think we'll find more of the details will be developed, as Jason suggested earlier, in September. And I think once that gets underway, we're going to see initiatives on a whole slew of other areas that need to be worked upon.
Let's pause for a moment. We'll return and welcome phone calls. We're broadcasting live today from Appleton from the History Museum at the Castle. We have a nice audience with us, and they are asked to come to the microphone as we talk with our guests about, you know, any kind of political topic, be it healthcare or Iran or Iraq or racism in America or the economy. What am I missing? That's just a few that you can take on. We're also welcoming phone calls. We have a couple lines open right now. The number for on-air phone participation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're broadcasting live from the History Museum at the Castle. Our guests are Jason Brozek, who is Assistant Professor of Government and Professor of International Affairs at Lawrence University, George Waller, Assistant Professor, University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley, and we're going to go to our audience and then to phone calls. A couple lines are open, too. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Margaret from Appleton area.
Margaret.
Yes. I have a question about, I'm really excited that the Obama administration is talking to places like the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic and the American Medical Association to talk to doctors about what's working well. One thing AMA has asked for again and again is some movement on tort reform to keep down the costs of malpractice insurance. In states where those tort reforms have been passed, it's really helped with the overall cost of health care. And I'm wondering if that's being addressed at all.
Thanks. I'm not sure it is. Thank you, Margaret. Do you know, George?
No, I haven't heard it as part of what's being currently discussed in the current versions of bills in the House and Senate, but I think it's probably something that will emerge as one of the details that needs to be taken care of. I mean, clearly it's an issue that there are people who have an interest in dealing with, and it is an issue of cost containment. I mean, at least from the perspective of those in the American Medical Association, one of the things that adds to the costs of health insurance premiums are the lawsuits that are associated with malpractice. So I haven't heard anything emerge in the bills. I'm sure that it will be something that will be worked out later on.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we're going to go to a phone call now. Diane is calling us from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have an idea for paying for health care. I don't know how many average trades there are buying and selling on the stock market every day, but if you charged a half a penny per dollar for every one of the trades, someone would have to figure out how much the average trades are and if that would be enough, or if it's too much, a quarter of a penny per trade, and see how much money you could make out of that. It would be just a little bit for every trade, you know, because if you have if you had a penny on a dollar, it would be $100 worth of stock would only cost you a dollar, but it would add up.
What made you think of this?
I don't know if I heard it somewhere or if I came up with it, but every day they talk about the stock market going up and down and how much money some of the people are making on the stock market by gambling practically. And I would think that that would make a lot of money, and it would be a small, and it would come mostly from the people who have the money. Instead of doing it on the income tax where people can complain about it, it would just, they're already paying fees to the companies that make these trades. Just add another half a penny, or depending on what the average number are.
This is why you love working for a radio station like this. You get, you know, these kinds of ideas. Jason, is she on to something?
Listen, Diane, I love the idea of creative funding solutions. one of the funding solutions that I've read about that I think is really fascinating is the idea of small taxes. Good idea. The idea of small taxes on large McDonald's French fries. Small taxes on 20-ounce bottle of Pepsi. If you want to pay an extra 5 cents for your high fructose corn syrup, then that's how we pay for health insurance.
Jason, I've actually heard that as a proposal that's been advanced in some sort of serious discussion, the idea of sin taxes as a way of providing some revenue to pay for this and also achieve the goal of essentially dealing with what you referred to earlier as the modern American lifestyle. I'm not sure, Diane, with your proposal, whether I'm trying to think in my head how that would be actually administered, who would collect it, how it would be sort of just dealt with, but it's a creative idea.
Yeah, it's a very creative idea. And why is it, why don't we move beyond cigarettes? Cigarettes are, you know, should be outlawed, I think, but why is it that we don't move beyond that in terms of taxing things that aren't very good for us? We've done it with cigarettes. Why don't we do it with what you just mentioned? We don't know.
Boy, I think it's politics, politics, politics. You tell people that you're going to start taxing them for the things they enjoy and the things they like, and I just don't think you're going to find a politician who's going to stick his neck out that far to go to those measures. Although there is some merit, I think, in the idea.
Yeah, there is.
I think it takes a long time. It took a long time to get cigarettes to the point where you could tax them as a sin. I've been watching Mad Men on DVD the past few nights, and I don't know if you've seen it, but I'm shocked by the amount of smoking that goes on in this movie this TV show that isn't set that long ago. It's incomprehensible today, and that's just a few decades past. And I think we're just not at that point with fast food or soda.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi, my name is Rana Swift, and just to comment on what you two were talking about, I wish our country would do what Obama was talking during the campaign and when I went to the rallies, which is let's move beyond the individual arrogance of me, me, me. We need to look at the whole picture, and as a recently retired educator, we need to look at education, not fear and more taxes. What I really want to talk about, though, is the fact that the Bush authorization for sending the National Guard to war has expired. There is a national effort to bring the Guard home, including here in Wisconsin. And the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice out of Madison, the local people, are involved. We're trying to get the state legislature to get a bill through and signed by the governor, giving the governor the authority to make a decision whether Wisconsin has to send the Guard to war. And the governor should have the right to do that. He did in the past, before the Bush authorization. We really need our National Guard people here. They're supposed to be here to help in times of national disaster and to maintain safety. It has caused many problems for families, police, fire department, sheriff's department, corrections departments, etc. And what we need to do is look at getting the governor and the legislature going more on this.
Thank you for your comments. Jason?
I think you're certainly right that we're stretching our military very thin and asking these young men and women who are already sacrificing so much to sacrifice even more. Again, I'm in favor of relieving that burden on the military.
Let's talk a little bit more about our foreign involvement. We were talking about the cost of the war in Iraq. I haven't heard those figures released recently, but it was an astronomical amount of money every day. The president has sent more troops to Afghanistan. Maybe there's not a clear aim of what we're doing there or how long we're going to be there. We're starting to withdraw from Iraq, but it's a slower process. I'd like both of you to give us an assessment. Start with whatever country you want to. Do we have a clear mission in Afghanistan? Is it a very expensive mission for us, as Iraq has been? And I'm wondering where you think Iraq's going to be a year from now.
Boy, that's a handful. I think one of the things that we are witnessing is that it is much, much more thorny and difficult to extricate yourself from these kinds of things than to get in. And we got in, and we got in a big way, and we went over there with the idea that we're going to sort of rebuild these democracies, rebuild countries and into democracies. And, you know, that's not something that happens overnight. I mean, we're talking about a region of the world that doesn't have a history and tradition of that kind of governance, a region of the world where basic sort of infrastructure programs are not established at all, and you cannot establish any kind of workable democracy without a basic economic infrastructure, without law and order infrastructure, with a whole host of things. I think with Afghanistan, I'm thinking that Afghanistan is becoming more and more of a problem. I think we're seeing the Karzai government sort of unravel there. I think we're seeing a retrenchment of or a reinvigoration of the Taliban in Afghanistan, in the regions that border Pakistan. I think we're seeing a kind of return to the tribalism that used to characterize Afghanistan, and I'm not certain just exactly what our mission is and whether it's well-defined, and I'll let Jason speak to that as well.
Wow, I think that's right on, and I wish that I had more to say or more to add, but I couldn't agree more. That I think that Iraq a year from now, other than the withdrawal of combat forces, I think the situation on the ground for Iraqis is not going to look fundamentally different. Afghanistan a year from now, I wouldn't even commit myself to a prediction. I don't know what Afghanistan will look like 2 months from now, and I don't know what the U.S. or the international community would like Afghanistan to look like a year from now. I think that's a problem. I think the lack of a clearly stated end game or a clearly stated goal, I think that's a serious problem.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. How do you get to that? Why are we in that situation?
You know, I think a part of the problem is there are so many big issues worldwide, and so many countries are facing huge economic issues and climate change issues, environmental issues, and the like. And I think a lot of the countries of the world are just saying, you know, this is America's mess, and we're not ready for a conversation about what we need to do internationally to commit resources to rescuing a place like Afghanistan. America, you just deal with it. And I don't think there's an international will to deal with that. I think Jason's right. I don't think anybody knows what to do about Afghanistan. I don't think the conversation has really started internationally on what to do about it.
Our phone number, 800-486-8655. We are broadcasting live from Appleton today from the History Museum at the Castle, welcoming your phone calls and also anybody who's in our audience who would like to come to the microphone. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Jeff from Nina, healthcare. The advocates of single payer seem to be saying that there's no way that a public option and a private insurance option can coexist because the privates would, as they say, cherry pick the most healthy, leaving many, many, many poor people to be covered by the public. But now, would it be correct to say that when they're going to require the privates to take people with pre-existing conditions and not drop people who become sick, that issue has been addressed? You know, or do you feel that the idea of both of these service tracks existing simultaneously is not possible?
George, you want to start?
You know, the single payer ideas would really represent a sort of radical change from the way we have traditionally dealt with healthcare in this country. We have primarily an employer-based system. I think what the idea here is that with the public option, you create the competition with the private insurance companies to provide a kind of insurance exchange. But both of the bills in the House and Senate currently would not represent a whole lot of change for people who currently have their insurance provided by employers. In fact, you'd probably see very little change if you currently have your insurance provided by employers. You know, the single payer idea is one that just hasn't had the sort of political capital to really get support in the Congress of the United States. And I think it's really because it would represent a real shift in the way we provide health insurance in this country. And, you know, it would essentially mean with a single payer system that you are doing away with the system of private insurance carriers. And that would have, I think, from the perspective of many conservatives, including Blue Dog Democrats, a devastating impact on the stock market, on the nation's economy, because essentially the stocks of all private insurance companies would simply be wiped out. And I don't think there's a will for that kind of catastrophic change.
Let's go to a phone call next, and it is Tim from Wausau. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Great. All right, Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well. I guess my question is, would we even be having this debate if we still considered our legal republic? We're not a democracy. We are technically still a republic, which means, in, I guess from my best judgment, it means the majority, which equals the majority of tax-based payers. Now, wouldn't it this universal health care system be undermining? And the last caller was correct. It would have catastrophic events based on the fact that we are a republic, and it would undermine the private sector's efforts to facilitate a strong country by diversifying all of our private sector funds into a public competitive healthcare system.
Jason.
Well, I would say, Tim, if we're going to drown the government in the bathtub, to use Grover Norquist's language, we've got a lot of other programs to dismantle first.
Okay, thanks very much for your call. Just a reminder, those of you who are in our audience here, grab a microphone if you want to talk. We're covering a ton of topics this hour as we're looking at political subjects, so feel free to just go right up. Did you want to comment? You look like you were...
Well, no, I've heard this argument before that America is not a democracy and it is a republic. We are a democratic republic, and I think there are... The idea that, you know, we are majority rule is not really... the be-all and end-all of what defines our democratic republic. I mean, the founders were quite keen on providing mechanisms which would protect the views of the minority and have institutionalized that in American government. So we are a government of majority rule, but with specific and intentional protections for the rights of the minority as well.
Speaking of the minority, what do you make of this Professor Gates from Harvard situation? You know, the president... It was so striking me to watch, we didn't have a lot of time to watch the news, but I was listening to African-American reporters who really were incensed by what happened here and then brought up their own stories about how people didn't believe they could drive a nice car or, you know, aren't you the nanny instead of the mom at this private school. It reopened, and we keep reopening this issue. And the president, you know, we're in one of those moments in history. Here's the African-American president who's commenting on this as well, and I was struck by it. What do you make of that? It's not over, is it? This issue isn't over.
No, I think this issue isn't over, and I think it clearly points to the idea that racism is not dead, electoral results notwithstanding. President called it stupid, and
yeah.
I think, you know, bravo to him for using strong language, as much heat as he's taking for it this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is taking heat this morning, but I think he's absolutely correct. I mean, the reality is that race has been a kind of an ongoing struggle throughout American history, and I think it clearly is today. If anybody thought that the election of an African-American president of the United States would somehow throw the racial divide in this country under the rug, I think we're seeing that that's not the case. It's a long, hard struggle to deal with those kinds of issues.
It's too bad, isn't it? You do have this momentous event that's taken place in history, and then something like this happens, and you think, oof, deflates you in a way.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of hope among many Americans that we're beyond it.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately, there hasn't been a real engaging and honest and frank discussion about race in this country. We have not yet arrived at that point.
Good morning.
I'm Judy from Chilton, and I just wanted to just get back to healthcare because, I mean, there's just so many different discussions, but I just want to ask a simple question. Why can't we just move, you know, whether a republic or not a republic, you know, that's really nice to discuss, but what if we just moved the Medicare age to 50? We already have a plan. We already have a system. And then in 10 years, move it down to 40. And then in 20 years, move it down to, you know, everybody. We already have a system that works. My in-laws, you know, use it. My mother uses it. She's had quadruple heart surgery. They've had, you know, multiple, you know, knee replacements, hip replacements. It seems to work, and it's rather cheap for them. So we have a system. It works just fine. Why can't we just keep lowering the age till we're all covered? George.
Which would, in effect, be a government-provided single-payer system. right. And I think, you know, there's the issue. There are some very, very entrenched private insurance interests out there who, let's face it, after all, there are people who invest in those insurance companies. Those insurance companies want to make money for their stockholders. There's all sorts of these kinds of questions and interests that people have an interest in protecting. I think your idea is an interesting one. I'm not sure how much political capital it would have, but might be something to look into.
Hmm. Jason?
I think it's a fantastic idea, too. And in my mind, I think that health insurance reform and health care reform has to go along with health reform. And that's a point that gets lost in this debate a lot. I think that health care reform has to be accompanied by combating obesity. I think healthcare reform has to be combated by addressing and overhauling the food system in the U.S. by expanding education, by expanding access and availability of food. And this is, I'm glad to see that this is an issue in the popular media is getting more and more coverage with Michael Pollan and
yes.
The new The End of Overeating. I'm glad to see that this is getting more coverage because I think that's equally as important as health insurance reform.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Hi.
Good morning. My name is Bryce. I'm from Fremont. And Jason, I would certainly agree that the emphasis on health, more activity, and the food is certainly very critical. In tying in with the health care, in my readings, I have read that we spend about $2 trillion a year on health care, which is about one out of every $7 that is spent in this country. As we're hearing this morning, there's an awful lot of profit. There's an awful lot of entrenched interests from insurance companies to stock markets, so on. In my mind, a discussion that hasn't happened, at least that I've heard or read about, is are we going to be treating health care in this country on a more very basic fundamental question? Are we going to treat health care as we do with a utility company, like with, you know, with an electric company, natural gas, that it's a universal type right that everybody has access to, or are we going to treat this as more of a privilege of something that only those that can afford to have it, which is basically what we have now, since we have roughly 47 million that are uninsured in this country right now. So I certainly agree that it is an issue that we need to deal with, and I'd just like to hear your comments. Thank you.
George, you want to start?
Well, you're absolutely correct. I think the president made the point last night, and it's absolutely indisputably true, that the most expensive option out there is the status quo. So we need to do something about that. I think there's also the moral argument, which the president referred to last night as well, and that is it is for a country like the United States of America, to have 47 million people uninsured or underinsured, and it's probably even more than that who are underinsured, is a kind of a moral question for a country like ours. There are those who say that health care ought to be a basic right. If indeed the Declaration of Independence says we're entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that one of those things ought to be to guarantee basic health care coverage for citizens in this country. That's a moral question, and it's nice to have discussions about that, but you know, things often boil down to the money, things often boil down to the interests and the stakeholders, and I think that's part of what's involved.
It is a moral question, isn't it, Jason?
Well, the United Nations has resolved the moral question. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that access to health care is a basic fundamental human right. And I think you're right, Bryce, that treating it as a privilege has been disastrous, and I think that we can't continue on that program. The numbers I've heard are that public spending on health care is about $4,200 per person per year, which is the highest in the world, and yet Americans have I think it was something like the 37th or 38th best health, which is embarrassing.
Yeah. Let's go to, let's pause. We have to pause, and then we'll return and take more of your phone calls. Please, audience here in Appleton, you're invited to grab that microphone and talk about any issue you'd like. And our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We are broadcasting live today from Appleton from the History Museum at the Castle, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and we're broadcasting live from Appleton and welcoming your phone calls and the live audience. Let's go to the audience here, and then we'll go to a phone call. Hello.
Hello. I'm Scott, and I had a comment about employer-based health insurance being so 20th century. All of the United States competitors, other countries, have public plans. We don't. The average cost of insurance for a year is $12,000 to $15,000, which is $6 to $7 an hour extra labor cost. Who are we kidding? We're now almost no manufacturing in this country. We are paying for our health insurance by losing jobs. And we're not very good at getting jobs back in the manufacturing area. Last comment, my insurance went up 42% this year. American lifestyle, I bicycle 100 miles at a time, I eat right, there is no break.
Whoa, that was really an increase in health insurance, huh? Who wants to start?
I think you're absolutely correct. And again, the president made this statement last night that employer health care costs are gobbling up the dollars that might otherwise be available for wages and salaries. There's no question but that the employer-based insurance system has imposed burdens on businesses in providing those plans for their employees. And I think as to your, you know, the no break, part of the problem with insurance companies is that currently private insurance companies, they engage in the practice of, you know, if you're sick, you're not a good candidate for coverage under their plan. They want to provide the insurance only to healthy people. What unfortunately happens is that those people who get kicked off, who are sick and need to utilize the insurance, end up utilizing health care in the most expensive fashion possible, which is in the emergency rooms, which is after things have developed to become to the point that they become hugely problematic. And again, this points back to what Jason had said earlier about the necessity of rethinking the way we do healthcare and focusing much more on preventative early care and covering people for that preventative early care so that we don't see the kinds of enormous costs associated with receiving healthcare delivery in emergency rooms.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with George more, and I wonder, and I haven't seen data or research on this, but I wonder to what extent that the employer-based healthcare system stifles entrepreneurship. Imagine it's hard to become an independent employee or a small business owner to take on that cost.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, we want to plug too. This isn't too far a drive for many of you, and there's a profound interest in healthcare. We are doing a major broadcast from Freightered on September 16, Rhonda. Both hours, we're going to do a live broadcast with people from the insurance industry. We've invited the administration down. We'll talk with doctors and people who are uninsured and all of that. So there are great voices out here today. Please come down for that broadcast if you can and be a part of the audience. You are really a good audience, aren't they? Yeah. You are really good. Yeah, so informed. Let's go to a phone call. Not that the phone calls are bad either. Joe from, I'm sorry. We'll go to you in a second, okay? We'll go to Joe from Madison and then come back to our audience here. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm calling, I was calling about the professor from Harvard, but your discussion on medical care intrigued me too because I think I've heard statistics that of the so-called 47 million, maybe 10 million are illegals. Another 10 million are probably people who don't care to pay the insurance premium, want to be without insurance, and so on. But the major point on health care, I think, is Social Security and Medicare are going broke. How can we add health care? What we have to do first is fix Medicare and Social Security. Medicare took on a big burden when it added prescription coverage for seniors. And the Medicaid program is being cut by the federal government assistance, so states have a difficult time funding Medicaid. But anyway, primary call was to talk about the Harvard professor, and he was cited for disorderly conduct. I know some white people that could be cited for disorderly conduct, too, when police would come to the house and try to figure out if the person was breaking in or not, and the person got out of control and would be cited for disorderly conduct. I wonder if this would have made the headlines if the professor had been white.
Well, he was in his house, though, and he showed him ID showing that he was in his house, and he showed an ID showing that he owned the house.
He showed an ID, but was he belligerent? Was he...
was his
uncooperative?
House.
Who knows that? But he got a citation for disorderly conduct, not for breaking and entering. And I think people are overlooking this, and it becomes a big deal because he's black. But how about if he'd been white and got a disorderly conduct ticket? Would it
I think
have become
it's
a big
deal because it happens to too many black people in this country. That's
but,
and that was the response that you saw. Excuse
it's
me.
It's a knee-jerk response. It's a knee-jerk. Just
what's
like
a
it is
response?
With... hate crimes. There's already a penalty for the crime. Why make it more because it happens to be against a minority?
George, you want to respond?
Well, you know, I thanks, Kathleen. I would just say that, you know, it is unlikely that this same kind of incident would have happened to someone who was white breaking into their house. I think what is unfortunate here is the idea that, you know, black people, Hispanic people, people of color, there's an automatic kind of assumption that they are suspect. You know, we've all heard of the driving while black. Well, this is living at your home while black. The man was at his home. He was locked out of his home. He was finding a way to break into his own home. Police officers responded correctly when they initially came from a call that somebody was breaking into a home. But when he produced his identification, which showed that he lived at that address and it was his own home, at that point, from my understanding, when he showed them that, he was handcuffed and arrested and cited for disorderly conduct. I don't think this would happen to someone who was white.
Thank you, George. Let's go to the audience.
I'm Marie from Appleton. I was wondering if we could cut off a little of the expense of the emergency room if we had a building for light cases, scratches, coughs, etc. Then have it middle, a broken leg. And I think when you get up to the end where a lot of tests are run immediately, because I go to the emergency room a lot for heart trouble, and they bring out all the... you know, artillery, that's more expensive. So let's grade it with different buildings.
That's a good idea. You have all these great ideas here. Appleton, where have we been? That's a good idea, isn't it?
I really like the idea of, trying to be creative with funding solutions. I think there are challenges with that sort of solution, challenges of overhead. I imagine that each one of those buildings needs a building manager and needs a supervisor, and we create some overhead and some bureaucratic costs. But I really do like the idea of separating out ER patients. What I'd really like to see, though, is people with coughs have easy access to their primary care physicians rather than needing to go to a special emergency room, even if it is the low-level emergency room.
That's a really important idea, and I think one of the challenges for healthcare in the United States is to encourage more people to go into primary care and primary practice or family practice. Unfortunately, there's been a sort of incentive for people to become specialists, to become surgeons and the like, and we really do have, and this is something else that hasn't been talked a lot about the current healthcare reform. If you're going to insure or provide insurance for almost all Americans, the president said last night he wants 97-98% of Americans now covered, you're going to focus on that kind of preventative care, you're really going to need to have primary care physicians and staff available to deliver that kind of service. And right now, we are struggling in this country
with getting enough people interested in going into primary care work.
We only have about 40 seconds left this hour. We never got to the climate change bill. Can you give us a few seconds? That's coming up soon, another huge issue for us.
Sure. Well, there was a great article in the New York Times yesterday mentioned that the battle over healthcare really left blood in the water, quoting from the title now, about the climate change bill. In my mind, either one would be a really significant accomplishment on its own. Put together, it's substantial. It's groundbreaking. Republicans are really trying to package the two as Obama's, capital letters, big socialism nightmare. Jim DeMint of South Carolina said about the health care bill, quote, if we're going to stop Obama on this, it'll be his Waterloo. It will break him. It's really a political issue. And I think that when the Senate starts talking about the climate change bill in September, I think there's a question of whether we're looking at snowballing political capital, whether there's been so much effort expended on health care that climate change has no support left, that there's no room left to compromise on climate change. I think that would be a disaster.
Thank you both very much. It was just a wonderful audience, wonderful guests, and great audience, too. Thank you. One of our best, I must say. My compliments to you. Jason Brozek is Assistant Professor of Government and Professor of International Affairs at Lawrence University, right across the street from where we are at the History Museum of the Castle. And you can come on down for the second hour, actually. The doors are open for you. George Waller, Assistant Professor, University of Wisconsin, Fox Valley, who's heavily involved in all kinds of political science topics. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks, Rhonda. And thanks to you, everybody, for being with us. We have news coming up. We'll be back.